Okay, well, first of all, though, I'd like to thank the organisers for giving me the chance to come to this very stimulating meeting. I have to say that every time I tell people I'm going to a meeting with all the string theorists, and the people who know me well find that extremely funny. But I always enjoy coming. I enjoy the conversations I can have with people. And it's absolutely true that the experiment I'm going to tell you about today was only really started because of previous fraudulent appearances at this type of meeting. So it was this kind of meeting that got me interested in potentially in electron hydrodynamics. So the collaborators on the project are listed there. The main people on the sort of key hydrodynamic paper are Philip Mull, Nabanila Nandi, Pallavi Kushwaha, and Burkhard Schmidt. But as you'll see, part of the talk is about the hydrodynamic experiment. Part of the talk has to be about why you would even try a hydrodynamic experiment on this material. So about half of the talk is about the material, and half of the talk is about the experiment itself. And specifically, what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about hydrodynamic flow in classical fluids. Obviously, I'll try not to just repeat the very nice introductions we had yesterday, and I'm sure on Monday as well when I wasn't here. Then I'll talk about the, from a materials perspective, even more about the challenges of electron hydrodynamics. Then I'll mention the unusual metal physics. Here's another word for you, Delafossite. So palladium cobaltate is a Delafossite oxide. And then we'll get on to the key bit, which is the evidence for a viscous contribution to transport, the type of experiment we did and what we think we could infer from it. I'll also try to be very honest at that point, and I'll mention one big surprise which comes out of the experiments. And obviously we conclude that the amount of things we do understand outweighs the amount of things we don't understand. You can draw your own conclusions about that once you've heard me speak. So, my kids are from the Google generation, so any information that you need, you go and get from Google. And this is an absolutely fantastic Googled graph from the internet. It has a completely meaningless x-axis. Right? But it does have a scale on the y-axis, and it's at least quite helpful to give you some idea of the viscosities of the kind of things that you might be used to in everyday life. The conversation before the talk says that olive oil there is an absolutely vital one to mention. Marco is telling us about his culinary expertise. So anyway, these are the things that Google tell you about. For people, at least experimentalists in this room, there's two other classical fluids, liquid nitrogen at 77 Kelvin and liquid helium at 3 Kelvin, are both pretty non-viscous. And I think anybody who's looked at liquid nitro and ethyl ether will see that you can kind of get a feeling for viscosity in the way that the liquids behave. So part of the talk is to return to this beautiful graph later and put some more points on it. So when I said that liquid helium-3 was a very non-viscous fluid, I was careful to do that at 3 Kelvin, just after it liquefies, when it's effectively a classical fluid. But then for a solid-state physicist, but not a hydrodynamicist, the very surprising thing is that the viscosity shoots up as you go down in temperature. And again, it's not intuitive at first sight to a solid state guy, because we all know that the scattering is going down and the mean free path is going up. So in that language, it's a better fluid. But of course, in the language of viscosity, viscosity is proportional to the mean free path for the internal collisions, right? And so it gets more and more viscous as it gets, in some senses, purer. And I thought I would mention this because it's a quantum fluid. And this is a very real effect. So we heard about how remarkable dilution fridge technology is yesterday. Actually, there's no reason in principle why a dilution fridge couldn't be operated all the way down to, sub-millikelvin temperatures. The pragmatic minimum of 7 to 10 millikelvin comes simply because this helium-3 becomes too viscous to force through the capillaries that you're trying to use. So, I can't possibly compete with the Columbus ship going across the Atlantic, but here's one more real-life manifestation of hydrodynamics, which is pretty important to people like me. So, this is not to redo everything that was said yesterday. The thing is that yesterday when people were discussing, they generally discussed in timescales. You've always got a choice when you're discussing a hierarchy between a timescale and a length scale. And everything I'm going to talk today will be in a hierarchy of length scales, so I just want to go over that for a moment or two. So imagine you have, 2D helium-3, if you could get it, flowing through an empty two-dimensional channel of width W. All of those atoms are bouncing off each other, and so the mean free path is the average distance between an internal collision of the fluid with itself. But none of that relaxes the momentum, which is the key point. The only way you relax the momentum is by doing a collision with the walls of the channel and losing your momentum to the outside world there. Therefore, and this is sort of explaining the idea. So the longer the mean free path for the internal collisions, the more efficiently the particles are able to reach the walls of the tube, and therefore the higher the viscosity. Right? And so, different ways of looking at it, I always think of shear viscosity as like a transverse coupling of the fluid to the outside world as it's flowing through something. And if you're in this limit, then as Leonid showed yesterday, you would start from a hydrodynamic theory, and in some range of parameter space, it would be the Navier-Stokes equations that you were solving to get that the width dependence of that flow resistance. And something to remember, it will be on the graphs later, it was mentioned yesterday, in two dimensions, the flow resistance predicted by Navier-Stokes goes as 1 over the width cubed, right? And that means now, but to confuse you even further, the data I'll eventually show will be in resistivity units, not in resistance units, and that takes one of the powers out. So if I show you something going as 1 over W squared in resistivity, that's like a flow resistance going as 1 over W cubed. And then here's the key challenge for electrons, is that they aren't flowing through an empty pipe. They're flowing through a lattice. And that lattice has many areas of perfection, but also usually many, many imperfections, like the points in red. And that means that the fluid is able to dump its momentum, the electron fluid is able to dump its momentum not just at boundary scattering, but also at the internal scattering, at these internal scattering points. And so you actually then have a second length scale to think about. You have the width, and you have the internal fluid-fluid collisions which conserve momentum, so that's L sub MC. And then you have these momentum-relaxing collisions which could be at the boundary, but they can also, in a real solid, be from the bulk. Okay, and more or less, everything I'm going to talk about needs to be expressed with a knowledge of these three length scales, always expressed as length scales. So now for the solid state, for the solid state physics specialists, the big problem is that I've mentioned electron impurity scattering as relaxing momentum, but actually there are many other processes in standard solids, all of which relax the momentum very efficiently. So it's extremely difficult to get into the regime you want, which is when you have the momentum conserving mean free path being shorter than the momentum relaxing mean free path. There's this old joke from, I guess it was Gell-Mann who upset everybody in our field by calling the field squalid state physics because it was so dirty. But unfortunately, there is some truth to that. As I say here, probably 99.9999% of materials are far too dirty for there to be a realistic chance of seeing a hydrodynamic effect in them. And we were hearing yesterday about how clean graphene is. Of course, that's why it's been one of the great choices and the very high mobility semiconductors. So the 0.00001% was led, as said yesterday by Gurji, I have to give this joke, but it's actually sadly another one of these things which is pretty true. Anything I ever get interested in, I get interested in because of modern theory. And then when I look back, I discover that the source paper was in the Soviet literature from before I was born. Now, I was born in 1964, so this is a close one, but it fulfilled my rule. So, and you know, I won't labor everything that Goetze said, and I'm slightly exaggerating it here, but he more or less, in a two-page paper, established this idea that everything you would see would be this competition of these three length scales. And just to remind you, so you're in standard Boltzmann regime if the momentum relaxing mean free path is much less than the momentum conserving one, which is also much less than the width. Then your scattering is all bulk scattering from the impurities. The sort of true hydrodynamic limit would be that the momentum conserving mean free path is much less than the width, so that you have very strong scattering going in your fluid flowing through the channel, and that both are much less than the momentum relaxing mean free path. It doesn't mean that you can't see deviations from standard Boltzmann theory when you always need, I think, this ratio between the momentum conserving and momentum relaxing mean free path, but hydrodynamic effects aren't restricted to the Navier-Stokes limit, so you can still see them when you have this of order the width, or even slightly smaller than the width. So we heard yesterday about the sensible attempt to look for hydrodynamic effect in very low density systems. So graphene is a, if you like, I shouldn't say this about graphene, but it's a special semiconductor, right? It's a semiconductor with lots of extras. And high mobility 2D electron gases are, of course, semiconductors with very low carrier concentration. And essentially that means that you're able to work close to or even above the Fermi temperature in some of those systems. And that's exactly what you want, because as was said yesterday, the phase space restriction of a Fermi liquid cuts down the momentum conserving scattering rate from electron-electron collisions. So you are really, if you were coming to the field with common sense and prior knowledge, you would not think of trying to do this in a metal with a large carrier concentration, right? And now, you could say that we're just foolish, and that may not be so far from the truth, but the thing is that we were very interested in palladium cobaltate because it's one of a series of layered metals of this class which have many anomalies from standard metallic behavior. So that's what I'm going to now spend. Apologies to the non-solid-state physicists. I'm going to spend about, I don't know, 15 minutes going through why palladium cobaltate is such an anomalous metal. So first of all, what does it consist of? Basically speaking, it consists of its triangular coordinated lattice. There are some stacking issues, you know, that there's actually three planes per unit cell, but you needn't worry about that. It's very two-dimensional, so the resistivity in this direction along the c-axis is about 1,000 times higher than the resistivity in the plane. And with some subtleties which may be important, but for now let's just ignore them, the conduction is dominated by the palladium states, or if you put platinum in, by the platinum states. So it's a little bit as if what you've achieved here is to get a rigid cobalt oxide spacer layer simply being used to separate triangular coordinated, and that's just pure triangular lattice, it's not an interleaved lattice like graphene, you've just got triangular layers of noble metals separated from each other in such a way that they become two-dimensional. Right now, there are other issues. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, but as a zeroth order approximation, that's what's going on. So here's the resistivity. Don't worry about the detail. We're going to return to the details in a minute. But first of all, I'll show you that we know a lot about the Fermiology or the Fermi surface. Yep.
Because it has a lot of angular dependence on the resistivity.
No, it doesn't. In plane angular dependence, it doesn't. But then by symmetry, you wouldn't expect it on a triangular lattice. Yeah, so it's 1,000 times higher for going perpendicular to the planes than it is for going in the plane. So it's, you know, very much very close to two-dimensional.
Yeah,
And we'll come onto that with the Fermi surface just right now. But so the other thing that I really like about it, you know, whether hydrodynamics is true or not, it's a very interesting benchmark model system for solid state physics, because most materials that one gets interested in have pretty complicated Fermi surfaces. They have pretty complicated electronic structure. This has a really beautiful, simple electronic structure where the Fermi surface, this is from a calculation just looking down on the plane, is pretty hexagonal, and there's only one band crossing the Fermi level. You don't instantly trust a band structure calculation in an interesting material, but this group from Korean colleagues about 6 or 7 years ago showed by photo emission that they can measure the single hexagonal Fermi surface, you know, with pretty high fidelity. We've since been doing some photo emission along with my students and collaborators on platinum cobaltate, where we were the first group to grow big enough crystals of that material to look at it. And again, you get this nearly hexagonal Fermi surface. I wouldn't be just repeating it for the sake of it. But if you're used to strongly correlated metals, this energy versus wave number diagram is really amazing, because it's extremely sharp, as you would expect for a very good metal. But look at this. This is a cut along this direction of the Brillouin zone. So you're just seeing the band dispersing up to here and to here. And what you're seeing is, as that dispersion is happening, until you get down into the continuum of cobalt oxide states, you just see a beautiful line. There's no sign of many body broadening. There's no sign of coupling to phonons or anything like that. Now, part of that is an optical illusion, because the Fermi velocity here is extremely high. It's about the same as the Fermi velocity of graphene, which is very high for a metal. But you know, this cleanliness of photo emission spectra just doesn't happen often when you look at you know, interesting materials that you might want to work on.
You have the width in energy space as well as a function of temperature, so you can make it positive the other way around, right?
Yes, you have it in energy space. It's extremely, there's no tricks here. It's extremely sharp in energy space, and it undergoes almost no thermal broadening up to the temperatures, which are about room temperature, where you can study it.
Is the width compatible with what you're going to get
through the resistivity? Is the width going to be compatible with the resistivity? Absolutely not. This is completely resolution and experimentally determined. The intrinsic width would be about 100 times smaller than this. And that, by the way, is also a pretty general problem in photo emission. Photo emission does not yet have the K and energy resolution to really look at these effects unless they're extremely pronounced. Right. And whereas you will read photo emission papers deducing crazy scattering rates, they're way too short in most cases when you get to good metals. And then you'll read excuses for why that's a genuine observation, but it almost never is. Well, Leonard said he got into trouble yesterday. If this is on the internet, I'm in trouble now, but I think that's basically the truth of it. So photo emission is K-resolved, so it's fantastic for getting Fermi surface shape. But the gold standard of whether you've got a Fermi liquid and for a really precise spectroscopy of Fermi surface is still the de Haast-Van-Alphen effect. So we did the de Haast-Van-Alphen effect as well on these crystals. And they just show you we have good oscillations. More or less, it confirmed all of what you would have thought from photo emission. And the combination of the two allows you to give these key parameters of the Fermi liquid. The thing to remember in terms of crazy people trying for hydrodynamics is that the Fermi temperature is about 30,000 degrees. And I'm going to later show you experiments at 3 Kelvin, and there's no way from first principles that you would expect those to work in terms of getting a strong enough momentum-conserving scattering rate.
So that's the same question again?
Yes.
So can you get the lifetime from the big hole time?
We you can, and we're going to... So the question... And Sean's asking is whether you can get the lifetime or the mean free path from the quantum oscillations. And indeed you can. I actually took it off this slide, so it would have been good if I'd left it on. But one of the first real anomalies here is that the de Haast-Van-Alphen mean free path is about a factor of 20 lower than the resistively measured mean free path. And that doesn't usually happen. So in a sense, so in that sense, you're thinking it's a material with a lot of forward, a higher than average ratio of forward scattering to backscattering. Resistivity is going to be dominated by backscattering, which is very good for what we want. And that was, again, one of the motivations that, you know, that's why I've got it in later. It was one of the motivations for us to try this. Right? And I have to say, we'll come into that in a moment. So here's the resistivity. Now let's think about the room temperature resistivity of palladium cobalt 8. And here is, at room temperature, the sort of hall of fame of the most conducting materials we know. So here's iridium oxide, and particularly rhenium oxide, which are famous as highly conducting oxides. Here are the alkali metals coming down here, and then there's a mess at the bottom in very, very high conductivity materials, low resistivity ones. So here's aluminium, gold, copper, and silver. Silver is the most conductive known element at room temperature. And here are palladium cobalt 8 and platinum cobalt 8. So it's really, materially, it's really kind of incredible that you would get a three-component oxide that has a conductivity comparable to copper or silver at room temperature. And in fact, there's more than that, because the carrier density, the volume carrier density, is about a third of that of copper or silver. So if you were really, if you were going to translate it into a scattering time or a mean free path at low temperatures, these have the, of any proper high carrier density metal, these have the longest room temperature relaxation times of anything that we know. And again, to see that in a three-component oxide is pretty strange. And it would also, I think, be pretty strange to see it if you could make, you wouldn't have imagined you'd have got it in an ideal world where you just made a single layer of triangular coordinated palladium. I didn't put, do we have palladium? Yeah, palladium's on here. So we're talking here a resistivity about a factor of 10 once you've normalized for carrier concentration, lower than the resistivity of elemental palladium. And I'm telling you that, that's just, I'm not going to give you an explanation of it because I don't think it's very well understood why this happens, but it's showing that the things are unusual. So now let's look at the low temperature resistivity, which also holds plenty of food for thought.
The elemental thing is not just 3D,
yet. The elements are 3D, yeah. But you know, if you look at other, obviously, you know, so the very, very highly purified 2D semiconductors can be got into that regime, but it took 30 years of work to get them there. Graphene is fantastic, but it has many special features, and it's a low-density system. In terms of, you know, there just aren't many high-density 2D materials to do a fair comparison with. So now, one small correction. There's just one little order of magnitude. The resistivity is actually even lower than Leonid said yesterday. It's about 10 nanohm centimeters or less at low temperatures. In some of the crystals, it's down to about 4 nanohm centimeters. At that point, the mean free path that you calculate from the known Fermi surface would be as much as 50 microns, I mean, which is just incredible. So the crystal we did the later experiments on had a mean free path of about 20 microns. So if you just operate in a very simplistic model and you draw that mean free path of 20 microns, consider the circle contained by that mean free path. There are about 10 to the 10 atoms in that circle, so in plane atoms. So the idea that you can just grow something out of a hot crucible with a multi-component growth and end up with purity at that level is very, very strange. And again, so the low temperature value of the resistivity is not well understood here. But it tells you, and this is again, it implies L momentum relaxing is 20 to 50 microns, depending on the crystal. And answering your question, Sean, L dehasphenalfen is about a factor of 20 lower than that. But it's the best thing to say is that these numbers are chemically implausible. So there may be some other explanation for them. Yes?
If I scale resistivity, find resistivity for one layer, what will I get? Something of order of ohms, centimeters, sorry, one ohm?
Yeah, you're getting...
One ohm.
It's way, way less, of course, than the quantum of resistance. So it's of order ohms. I'll give you the exact number afterwards.
So I should divide this number by 10 to the 8.
So Yeah, you should divide this number by. You should divide it by the interlayer spacing, which is, and the interlayer spacing is about 5 times 10 to the minus 10. So you divide that, you're going to get a bigger number.
So it gives 5 volts.
Yes, I think so, yeah. No. I'm standing up here in front. So you divide it by 5 times 10, so you get, that's of order 10 to the, it's about 10 to the minus 10 in meters, so you're dividing it by 5 times 10, so it's 0.2 ohms if I'm getting it right in front of you. So it's of that order. Yeah. Okay. Good. So this is about the value. Then there came something about the temperature dependence, because now when, just experimentally, when something has that lower resistivity and a real crystal has that lower resistance, it's actually not trivial to measure the resistance properly at low temperatures. So I think we were the first people to do a pretty low noise measurement on it, a low enough noise measurement that we got pretty good data fidelity as we came down. That's the black line. And what we had not expected to see, because we are traditional condensed matter physicists, we had expected to see the Bloch-Grunheisen T to the fifth fit for the resistivity, which is what you see in red. And the deviation isn't huge, but it's significant. It's well beyond the errors in the experiment. And what we then found was that we could actually fit an exponential onset to this resistivity. So the correct functional form, which is the blue line, which is very close to what you're seeing, is A plus B e to the minus T naught upon T, where T naught's about 165 Kelvin. Yes?
I was just noting that, so 2 has 3 parameters, and the power only has 2 parameters in the fit. So, I mean, if you have like a plus C times T to the 6, something like that.
No, you tried, of course, right, good, very good. I did this extensively myself, because you don't trust fitting. You can do log-log and you discover it's not a proper power. You can plot it in the appropriate way.
Let's say allow yourself one more subleading power only. So you have 3 maps, so that, you know, the parameters are the same.
Good. I think I've got the data with me. We can sit down and even try that, right? I messed around quite a bit and convinced myself I wasn't able to do it. But you always have to worry about these effects. Now I'm going to give you some more consistency checking, though. Okay.
So how do you measure such a small resistance? You use a bridge or what?
No, we use low temperature transformers. We have transformers mounted at 1 Kelvin. And they're amazing. I think the best that's ever been done is about half a picovolt per root hertz has been achieved in an experiment using low-temperature transformers. That was by Steve Julian on uranium-platinum-3. And they're fantastic because they're passive. So all you really need to do is you've got a dilution fridge, you have a 1K pot, you sit. All our dilution fridges have a stack of transformers sitting at 1 Kelvin, shielded by superconducting shield. Mm-hmm. And, this is actually what you end up being limited by at that level is how you mount your sample, because, you know, you've got any field isn't perfectly homogeneous. So if you've got any loops of wire vibrating in that field, you're going to get some pickup. So in order to go down below this, you have to mount the sample particularly carefully. Yeah. Now, it's not such a known fact, and it's really nice, right? Yep.
How much does the intercept A vary with
how carefully prepared to send? We clearly are very interested in trying to make it dirty in a controlled way. Our one attempt to do that made it dirty in an uncontrolled way. We did some ion irradiation and made a big change, but I think we basically we didn't get the flux quite right. The amazing thing about these crystals is that in terms of making them cleaner or something, there's no special precautions. These aren't special chemicals. It's been grown in a hot crucible, and you're just measuring what comes out. So, but clearly, and particularly in light of what Leonid said about hydrodynamic effects helping a hydrodynamic fluid miss impurities, I'd now be extremely interested at trying to go back to that and finally try to irradiate to make these things dirtier in a controlled way.
So do you understand what is exponentialism?
I think so, and I'm going to say that now. The questions are great, though. That's fine. So the exponential, in a sense, when you look back at the history of our field, you shouldn't be asking where the exponential comes from. You should be asking where the t to the fifth comes from. Because when Bloch and Gruneisen wrote down the Bloch-Gruneisen law, there's a huge assumption in there, which is that the phonon system is able to equilibrate so rapidly compared to the electrons that electron-phonon scattering is always done from an equilibrium bath of phonons. And even a couple of years after they proposed that theory, Pyles criticized it, and he said, wait a minute, it's not at all clear that the phonons are going to be able to equilibrate. Therefore, as the electrons are dragged out of equilibrium by the field and they scatter from the phonons, if the phonons can't equilibrate quickly enough, they're going to be dragged along with the electrons. So you give momentum to the electrons, and you also give momentum to the phonons. That would cut out what are called normal electron phonon scattering processes. And he pointed out that in those circumstances, the first electron phonon process that you'll see in resistivity will be an electron phonon umklapp, where you get the temperature high enough that you can scatter your electron across into the next Brillouin zone, and that does relax momentum. And Pyles' little note, another one of these little notes by Pyles, he just points out that an exponential, because that's a gapped process, if you like, an exponential dependence is much more natural than the t to the fifth. And you can check it because we know that distance in K-space because we know the Fermi surfaces. We know the sound velocity, so we can convert it into a characteristic temperature. And we get a characteristic temperature just from that estimate, which is within about 15% of what we measure. So, it's okay, it's a coincidence of numbers, but it doesn't look crazy that that's what you're seeing. And then, in fact, you then look back through the history of the field from the 1930s onwards, and by the 1950s, Conyers Herring was publishing papers saying that you expect this phonon drag to, behavior to be pretty ubiquitous. In Zeiman's book in the 1960s, he points out that this is a major assumption of standard transport theory that has to be questioned. But in fact, in the history of the field, the experimental groups found it very difficult to observe this exponential. So in some senses, it's a problem that's been forgotten about rather than explained, I would say. And one of the reasons it's so easy to see here is that this gap tends metals, the gap size is only about 10 Kelvin, which means you'd have to be at dilution fridge temperatures to really see the exponential dependence, whereas ours is much higher, not maybe it. But we're reasonably confident that we can explain the exponential. So, and that's the second thing then that really got us interested, because if you're dragging the phonons, the electron-phonon collisions are still going on, but they aren't relaxing the momentum, they're conserving the momentum. So the idea there is that normally electron-phonon collisions are the enemy of hydrodynamic behavior, but if you flipped around to here, they've become the friend of hydrodynamic behavior. And so that was, I think that was the key thing. Sean wasn't here when I said that previous conferences had really got my interest going. It's actually discussions with Sean that had interested me in this idea of momentum conservation versus momentum relaxation. So when I realized that the drag was going, I thought, well, maybe it's worth trying an experiment.
But how about the momentum relaxation in the electron side and the phonon side? Which one will start to dominate as it in the hydrodynamics as you proceed? Because some of the momentum is being transferred from the electron to the phonon, but then there's a momentum relaxation in the phonon system.
Yeah, but if the momentum relaxation in the phonon system is very slow, essentially the phonons give the momentum back to the electrons very efficiently. So the overall momentum of the combined electron-phonon system in that set of processes is quasi-conserved. Until you get some umklapp scattering. That's the idea.
have it on.
I promise.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Just switch it off.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, so I've got a related
question.
So if the phonons are getting dragged, does it mean that the hydro you should be looking at is a hydro that has both the electrons and the phonons? That's the hydro problem.
I think it might. I am not really, this was our motivation, right? What I'm going to say will be much more careful, just we're going to show you a fit where we lump all the momentum conserving collisions just into this momentum conserving mean free path without any further microscopics.
So your later theoretical model was fascinating.
Yeah, the later model doesn't actually depend crucially on microscopic details at all. It's actually Mollenkamp's model, as we'll say, but that's the fact of it. So since effective dimensionality came up yesterday with one of the great looks from Leonid, I thought I should just make some things clear to you, because they're kind of obvious for a guy who's worked on layered systems all his life, but they certainly won't be obvious to some people in the audience. So here we go. So here's the Fermi surface not looked at from the top, but looked at from a nice angle, calculated Fermi surface in the Brillouin zone, so that you can see that the Fermi surface is more or less a perfect cylinder as it disperses down the Z direction. And actually, the calculation gets some things wrong, and it greatly, even that little rippling that you're seeing is a big exaggeration compared to measurement, and we can prove that. So it's nearly a perfect cylinder. So now let's imagine a little rectangular parallel prepared of a sample. We're going to do an experiment on that sample, and let's just then think of the side-on face. So the plane, that's the top face, this is a side face. So the side face is a whole series of conducting planes. And then actually for the kind of experiments that we're doing at the moment, you want to inject current and take it out from the top of the sample. That is a problem if you're not aware of it, because most of the current is going to flow in the first few layers because it's so anisotropic perpendicular to the plane. And particularly, you won't get much current going too deep in the sample at all. So you have to be aware that that's a potential experimental issue. But if you make the sample longer, you see that it gets to be less of an issue, and I didn't redraw the current pass. The current is going to get more homogeneous, and near the middle of the sample, there's going to be an area where the current, if the sample is long enough, there will be an area where the current's flowing equally through each plane. So that's my beautiful piece of graphics to give you that happy situation, right, where you've made the sample long enough. And you can calculate and even measure what long enough is. And by the time you have equal current flowing in every plane, then it's appropriate to think about the theory in a two-dimensional approximation, in the sense that as the current flows along this crystal, boundary scattering means scattering at those two edges with negligible probability of scattering at the top and the bottom. Right? And so it's in that sense that I would say that this is, yes, it's a three-dimensional material. You can actually drive your experiment into regions where you're making use of the three-dimensionality, but you can also work in a region where it's effectively a two-dimensional system. It's just a stack of layers of two-dimensional systems in parallel. And that is, the cartoon of the regime I hope we worked in. So the experiment was just the following then. We had thought about Navier-Stokes' behavior as a function of channel width for channels of separate widths. So with a focused ion beam these days, if you've got the right chemistry in your sample, which we do have here, you can make the sample physically into a series of widths. So we actually did it sequentially. We would start with a sample of this width. Then, as shown there, another cut would be put in with the same voltage contact separation to make it a narrow width, measure it, make it a narrow width, measure it again. So that was how it was done. And importantly, the whole, to the extent that this result we're telling you about is true, it's true only because of the comparison of the data with the theory that Mollenkamp and de Jong wrote down. So I better tell you about that theory and why I think it's plausible. So what they did was to take standard Boltzmann theory, and they explicitly included the momentum conserving terms, which are ignored in almost all textbook Boltzmann theory. And they then wrote it in such a way that you have, what I'll say, eventually an intuitive parameterization just in terms of these three length scales. And in principle, this model gives you predictive capability in any ratio of them, which is extremely useful. It's a pragmatic theory. It's very, very useful for an experimentalist. And we didn't change the theory. What's done is written down in the supplementary information of our paper, but what Burkhard Schmidt did was to digitalize it to allow us to solve it for any geometry that we needed, which was very useful to us. Here I'm just showing what was shown by Leonid yesterday, that de Jong and Molenkamp used the theory, you know, as he said, with some caveats to explain their own data. But what we were interested in was how things were going to look with that theory and our data. But first of all, let me take you back to an earlier paper by Beinacker and Van Houten, in which they solved the idea of transport in channels in the purely ballistic limit, or in other words, in the limit where they... Oh, this is going to be easier maybe just to do this. In the limit where they were considering scattering without any momentum conserving, so you're thinking about ballistic electron transport to boundaries in the presence also of collisions from those impurities, but you're not thinking about any momentum conserving scattering at all. And so here's the curve that they get, and this curve is a curve of resistivity, or it's the way we plot it, resistivity normalized to the resistivity of an infinitely sized sample. So you start at 1 on the y-axis, and you're plotting it against the mean free path that you've got for momentum relaxing collisions normalized to the width. Now that's the only two, this is a two-scale theory because there's no momentum conserving scattering being considered. And what you have, and so now let's see if it makes sense. So as you restrict from being an infinitely wide sample to being a slightly narrower sample, it tells you that the resistivity goes up, and it goes up more or less linearly. And the reason for that is that, of course, boundary scattering matters, and that linear dependence is this combination of direct electron trajectories with directions that allow them to reach the boundary, combined as, if you like, direct ones with ones where they bounced off the impurities. Okay, and the prediction is just that you get this linear rise. At this point, the bulk scattering, you know, is still important because it's essentially saying that the width is of order the same size as the bulk impurity distance, so you get a kind of natural combination of the two. Now, if we go out to large numbers of mean free path divided by width, it means we have a very narrow channel. And when we've got a narrow channel, you might say to yourself, well, why didn't the linear increase just carry on? But there's an effect. Well, one, you've got very few bulk impurities left, so you're not getting, I think, much transverse scattering from the bulk impurities that you worry about. But more importantly, you'll always have a distribution of ballistic electron directions in 2D. Right, and the resistivity gets shorted by the electrons which are traveling parallel to the boundaries. They can obviously go further without hitting the boundary than the ones that are going transverse. And gradually, as the thing gets more extreme, you short them out. They short out the boundary scattering. So the resistivity increases, but it increases sublinearly. Now, the other thing about this theory, which really, really, really appealed to me, is that if you express this theory in terms of these two dimensionless variables, that's it. There are no free parameters. You know, it's not often that our theory colleagues slip up that badly to give you a theory with no wriggle room, right? But there's no free parameters whatsoever, so according to that, that's the answer. And we really liked that because we then thought, well, if we measure something different, there may be some physics there. So now what we do is we go from that theory to the Molenkamp theory, Molenkamp and de Jong theory, and at the moment, just with advanced wisdom, we plot on the same graph the prediction of the Molenkamp and de Jong theory when you have the momentum conserving mean free path about a tenth of the momentum relaxing one. Obviously, that's about where I'll show you we think our experiment is, but let's just look at the two theories and compare what they're doing. So here we have the same ordinate axis as before, but it's helpful also to put the momentum conserving mean free path normalized to the width on top, and obviously it's just a tenth of the bottom axis. So down at large widths, what you're seeing is that the, as was mentioned by Leonard yesterday, you see a curvature in the prediction, and that curvature is almost quadratic, which is like the quadratic in 1 over W terms is 1 over W cubed in resistance, because this is a resistivity curve. So that's very like the Navier-Stokes equation solution, not perfectly like it, because we still have some impurities, but getting very like it. And basically, and it's also lower than the ballistic prediction. And that's because with these very wide wires, the way I think of it is that the diffusion given by all these collisions makes it harder for the electrons of a given momentum relaxing mean free path to reach the boundary. So the resistivity is lower than the ballistic limit, and it has this Navier-Stokes type curvature. Then at very high, very narrow wires, you're incredibly narrow in this scale in comparison to the momentum relaxing mean free path, but you're not yet incredibly narrow in terms of the momentum conserving mean free path. So those momentum conserving collisions are now crossing over to helping you reach the boundary. So you've got a higher resistivity than the pure ballistic prediction. And the theory correctly shows you'd expect in that logic to be crossing over somewhere near when the width becomes of order the momentum conserving mean free path, and it's about half. I mean, it's pretty good. This is a numerical theory, but it looks very sensible what it does. Okay, so I'm saying this to you because now I show you our data, and magically, because we chose that particular number of the parameter ratio, our data sit very close indeed to the prediction of that theory. But nothing that we've written about a hydrodynamic interpretation is correct unless we believe that theory and we believe that that's the correct way to be interpreting our data. That's what our whole claim rests on. Yep.
Was this a fit for the ratio of the two perhaps, or was that something independent?
This is. I don't have the graph in me. I'll show you afterwards. It's not a straight fit. If you did the straight fit, you would get a slightly different ratio. But the dependence on the ratio between, so this is for momentum conserving being a tenth of momentum relaxing, between about a 20th and a fifth, you wouldn't get a big change. It's quite a flat landscape.
Did you measure that ratio in another way?
We didn't measure it in any other way. I mean, we were motivated to start in this area of parameter space by the ratio of the Dahasven-Alfvén mean free path to the momentum relaxing one. But that's not a logically consistent thing to do, actually. That's all about elastic scattering. And this is now about inelastic, I think.
So how do you extract the LMR?
So the LMR is extracted because you know the Fermi volume exactly, you know the Fermi surface area exactly, and so you know KF, and it's a 2D material, so sigma is equal to, always going to need to get it right, it's H upon E squared, KFL, mean free path. And so, you know, it's about as reliable as you'll ever be in trying to get that mean free path out from the measured conductivity. But then you can also, which I didn't include for reasons of time, you can also look at how when you turn on a field, at what cyclotron radius do you pinch off from the edges of the wire? And that works beautifully, and that is only going to work when the momentum relaxing mean free path is of order the wire width or greater. Right, and we really see that we only see that pinch-off effect when we bring the wire width down to that value that we had of the mean free path. I was really surprised at how well that worked. We can talk about that again more afterwards if you're interested. So anyway, so there's the data, and if we blow up the data at wide wires, you see the curvature. It's only 4 points. But the thing is that the data cross the universal line in about the right place. Again, for this choice of ratio of mean free paths, there's no free parameter about the, but beyond doing that, there's no free parameter about that magnitude. So everything looks about right, the magnitude, the shape, and the curvature at a high width. So that looks good. You would tend to believe us when we see, I believe me when I look at that. However, when you look at the temperature dependence of what we get, you get worried. Because we do see a temperature dependence. Again, this is now rather complicated. Don't pay attention to the details. We can discuss it afterwards. We see a temperature dependence, but it's quite a weak temperature dependence. We can match it by, roughly speaking, by calculation. But the implication of doing that match is that the momentum conserving mean free path does not vary nearly as rapidly as you would expect for electron scattering as temperature, and it doesn't probably vary nearly as rapidly as you would expect for standard electron phonon scattering either as a function of temperature. And that we certainly don't understand. And so it's always a question of, you know, how convincing is the good side relative to the problems you've got? We judged that the good side was interesting enough to publish this paper, but you know, we should be very honest. This is from the supplementary information. We do discuss this point. We should be very honest about the fact that it's not like we have a completely self-enclosed set of evidence that this is really hydrodynamic. But you know, given that when I was introducing the material, I went through a whole list of other parameters which are kind of favorable for hydrodynamics, none of which we understand. I'm prepared to live with this lack of understanding for the moment, but it's clearly something that we need to work on and try and understand for the future.
So what is the electron-electron scattering time that's
what temperature? Well, so there's two things. This is at 3 Kelvin in a Fermi liquid with a 30,000 degree Fermi temperature. So actually, even the absolute estimate of what that time should be would never give you a mean free path of 2 microns, right? And so missing that temperature dependence is much more like the source of momentum conserving collisions here, if they're there, probably isn't simple electron-electron scattering. And then I tried to calculate cross-sections for electron-phonon scattering and got confused, so I'm not totally sure about the electron phonon. And I also wonder what the electron phonon is going to do when you're in a phonon drag regime. You know, is this coupling between the electrons and the phonons itself going to affect the temperature dependence of that scattering? I'm confused. I just honestly don't know. So if we just go back to the beautiful diagram from Google, I should put this on Wikipedia to make everybody happy. But here we have a quantum degenerate liquid helium just above its superfluid transition. And here we have all of the electron experiments to date, where electrons in graphene 1 is the experiment from the Geim group, where you're away from the degenerate, from the Dirac point. And tell me if you disagree with this. I think that when you're near the Dirac point, like was discussed yesterday, then the viscosity is about a factor of 10 lower. Because the scattering, you know, the mean free path is shorter. But if I've got that wrong, you can come and correct me later. Anyway, but the main thing is that it definitely confirms what was said yesterday. Electron systems generically, so far, have all been pretty viscous, and that means high Reynolds number, and it means unlikely to be able to get to electron turbulent regimes. However, I'm hopeful that we can go further, because you have these well-known phase diagrams from many interesting correlated systems where the resistivity goes linear. And one of the things we're thinking about there, everybody's thinking about there, is that scattering at this, if you like, Planckian limit that was discussed yesterday. So that's very strong scattering, probably the strongest you can get. It may well be that it will be possible to do some experiments in here that will tell you whether it looks like a hydrodynamic response or not. If you're able to do that in a very heavy fermion system in linear resistivity, then there's the prospect of bringing this viscosity that you're measuring down by one or two further orders of magnitude, I think. But that's all the dream. I mean, we're going to go on and continue to try these experiments and see if that happens or not. So the other thing, which I had on the slide already, but John was asking it yesterday, other than technical details, there's no reason at all why, if you get extremely pure three-dimensional systems, you couldn't try doing square cross-section wires and constricting like that. It's just much harder to make. So I'm roughly on time. Those are my conclusions. I don't really like reading conclusions out because I hope that you can read them yourselves and that they're reasonably obvious. So thanks for your attention.
Yeah, indeed. So this has been often time things is confusing, in fact. Right? So that is two length scales that are very separate. So a single particle length and a collective length. Right? And so, but actually, as you reminded me, this single particle one is an elastic one, right? Mm-hmm. It's not an inelastic one, right?
Correct.
And so that should be the disorder of relaxation.
But
the disorder is not angle dependent. So how? So
no. What it's saying though is that what's angle dependent? You know, it's you come along, you can scatter from that disorder potential either like this or like this. You know, and there's a distribution of those scatterings, and resistivity, of course, is famously biased towards the backscattering that relaxes the most momentum. The received wisdom is that the DHVA mean free path, because it's about dephasing in orbit, is much more sensitive to forward scattering than the resistivity, right? But observably, when you actually compare these mean free paths, which I've done many times in previous experiments, you find empirically that in most interesting metals and correlated systems, they're not so different. A factor of 20 difference is really big. And it's telling you somehow that the effect of the impurities is to give you much less backscattering than you would have expected. Actually, Leonid showed a hydrodynamic picture yesterday about impurities that would some qualitatively fit that bill, I think. You know, if you're flowing around the impurities because of a hydrodynamic effect, then that impurity scattering will not have as much backscattering component to it. And that could, if you can get the magnitudes right, which maybe you can't, but if you get the magnitudes right, that could reduce the reserved, that would be increasing the observed resistive mean free path by, say, a factor of 20. If it were increasing the observed resistive mean free path by a factor of 20, you'd be able to believe the number of defects you'd think you had in there, right? So just the sheer value of the mean free path that we see makes me think that somehow resistive scattering from impurities is being disfavored. And I was very excited when Leonid mentioned that hydrodynamic effects could conceivably be doing that.
Well, there presumably the impurities are supposed to be big compared to some electron.
Well, but the impurity, we always draw it as point impurities, but it's a charged impurity. The impurities could also be defects on the cobalt oxide plane. They don't have to necessarily be defects in the metal plane.
Can you image these things?
Not yet, but do we want to? Yes, we do. Yeah. No, we have a project going on where we're trying to do STM measurements from this. But then there are always, the trouble with STM is to do it, you cleave. When you cleave, the top surface that you're looking at can have far more defects in it than it would have had in the bulk.
If I'm correct, the observation of the phonon phenomenon is something that you can only see when there are many electrons in it. It's not something you can see in photo emission, is that right? A single electron carrying.
Yeah, it's not something that you think you would see in photo emission, unfortunately, no.
It doesn't affect.
Well, I mean, in photo emission's just nowhere near the resolution. Maybe, I need to think about whether you could see it in ideal photo emission. But photo emission has, it's improved incredibly. So it has the resolution to look at 100 angstrom mean free path cuprates at 100 Kelvin or something now. But something with mean free paths like this at low temperatures, there's no way its experimental resolution is good enough.
Yeah, is material structurally ordered in the z direction?
Yes.
Or is it like graphite where you have some random stick in ABC?
No, it's if you do the crystallography very carefully, you find it's pretty much perfect. So it's weakly enough bonded that if the X-ray crystallographer just cleaves it with a knife, he introduces a lot of stacking faults, and you see that very clearly in the diffraction. But if you've got the focused ion beam knife, if you very gently cut a little hexagonal piece out, then we did this, and he got beautiful diffraction spots. So, you know, has grown their order until you start to strain them by how you treat them.
So then this large resistivity anisotropy is a mystery?
No, the large resistivity anisotropy is purely, you know, you calculate it from the Fermi surface warping. So the large resistivity anisotropy is just due to, you know, what the wave function overlaps are in the z direction relative to what they are in the xy direction. So, and this is you know, fairly standard stuff. Remember that there's a, and the other thing is that I didn't come into all this. Another reason why we should all love Dellafossites is that you have this quasi-free electron metal layer, but the layer in between is very strongly correlated. It's a 3D cobalt oxide, and you can tell this because you can change the cobalt for chromium, and if it wasn't correlated, the Fermi level should dip down into the chromium levels. But actually what you see in the chromium is that you get a large moment Mott insulator separating the layers of metal. So the C-axis transport is actually not a trivial thing at all here. There's the warping of the Fermi surface, but B, there are correlation effects that the band structure isn't going to be getting properly for the C-axis.
So here in your theory, you are adding momentum conserving effects to the ballistic theory?
Correct.
How about going the other way around? Start from either
momentum relaxing. Okay, so good. The term your theory was again quite ironic. The theory that we are using, which was written down by Mohenkamp and not solved by me, I think it would be extremely. I mean, it would be extremely useful to go that way. Now, some of Leonid's calculations you've put in. The effective of disorder, right? You've put in resistive scattering also. So Leonard's always already working that way. But before his work, every calculation I was seeing actually didn't have the disorder in it, which is not so useful because it's an absolutely intrinsic part of what's happening in solids.
Can you clean the material down to monolayer?
I wish we could. Actually, I may. Tape is not going to be able to do it, but now I've been looking at there are some liquid-based exfoliation techniques that people are using on other layered materials. What we actually know here, and it may be hopeful, we haven't done it yet, but we're very interested in trying. It wouldn't go down to a monolayer, but even getting it down to a few layers for our purposes experimentally would be very good. What we do know, which is hopeful, is that it seems to intercalate. So we can try some, my colleague Philip Marl did some electrochemistry on it, which we don't understand fully, but he certainly intercalated some things in between. And there's a huge science of that from sodium. So sodium cobaltate, the mud superconductor, where it goes superconducting when you intercalate it with water molecules, that has a very similar crystal structure to Dellafossite. So some of the techniques that have been used in sodium cobaltate may come over to us.
Yes, I think what Blaise might have mentioned, probably what Bennett and Andreas, professors have done is, so when you have, when the impurities are large, you can treat impurities within hydrodynamics and sort of move around them. But another thing you can do, if the impurities are microscopic, you can just add a term to the Navier-Stokes equation that says the momentum is just leaving the system.
Okay.
And it's a more microscopic, what's a different regime. It's a pretty well-defined equation. It's just Navier-Stokes equation with some extra term that's killing it.
Well, it's well-defined perturbatively, but the only non-perturbative approach may not work.
Yeah, but this maybe is a different issue. I'm just, let's say the impurities are not big in the system. I don't know how big they are. They may not be big. And then another thing you can do is just take the elements out. So everything's pretty weak here, right? So,
Well, you know, from the perspective of experimentalists working in this field, anything done to combine the two properly is vital, actually.
Okay, let's thank Andy again.